Freedom Guns is your local gun store for the Rockledge Cocoa area in Brevard County, Florida. Stop in and meet Mike and the gang and see the great deals they have on long guns, handguns, accessories, ammunition, AR build kits, and Liberty safes that come with free delivery and installation. They're located at 1255 Florida Avenue, just north of Rockledge High School. For more information, check them out at freedom-guns.com. Tell them you heard about them on the Shooting Straight Radio podcast.
The Shooting Straight Radio podcast is proudly sponsored in part by The Gun Sight in Merritt Island, with a 9-lane, 25-yard indoor shooting range, handgun and machine gun rentals, a fully stocked gun store with plenty of long guns, handguns, ammunition, and accessories to choose from. They're your one-stop shop in Merritt Island for all things necessary to responsibly exercise your Second Amendment right. Check them out at gunsightrange.com or stop by in person at 125 South Banana River Drive. And make sure you tell them that you heard about The Gun Sight on the Shooting Straight Radio podcast.
Well, you heard the man. He said it twice. Let's go, because we are locked and loaded on the Shooting Straight Radio podcast. This is the podcast all about firearms, the Second Amendment, and all things pertaining thereto. And you know me. I am Royce, your host and professor emeritus of constitutional studies, pouring it to you from both barrels with 100% felt recoil and no suppressor, and all while being heavily saturated with gunshot residue, toxic masculinity, and a faint yet wildly tantalizing whiff of the cologne of my people. Hops number 9, gun oil, baby, you know it. We've got a great program in store for you here. Going to be going, take a little trip down history lane here today, and I'll tell you more about that. Got a special guest here in the studio with me. First, I want to remind you about Rocker and the Redneck. Don't forget to catch that podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Also, Voice of the Blue. That's the one that I've been commissioned by the American Police Hall of Fame to produce for them, all about stories of the people who have served behind the badge, and boy, I'll tell you what, there's some very interesting and riveting stories that these people have to tell. It will increase your appreciation for them and hopefully put that human face back on the police profession that had been ripped away by a very vociferous media and other people. All right, let's take a little trip down history lane. It certainly isn't memory lane if you didn't live back then, but it is history lane. And I've got a special guest in the studio. You heard her here with me 9 episodes ago on the AFA angle, and she is back with us today. AFA, great to have you back.
Hi, Royce. So you weren't alive in 1788 either?
No. Some people think I was. I think my 14-year-old thinks I was. But
same here with my 17-year-old. Thanks so much, Royce, for having me back. It's great to be back here again recording with you. Yes, we are going to go down history lane today. I would like to start with first, though, extending my heartfelt condolences to you, Royce, following the election loss of former Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot. I know how hard you worked on that reelect campaign, and I'm sorry. It's a blow. It's a setback. We have to move on.
I'll try to get over it.
We can do it.
I might need counseling to deal with the excessive mirth and frivolity that has invaded my heart and soul since that day. But her reaction was predictable, was it not?
I think she blamed
racism, sexism, and anti-LGBT, LMNOP, whatever, you know.
It's mind-boggling, the detachment from reality, when you have presided over what's a very beautiful city that is mired in homicide and body bags, and you simultaneously allow that recklessness and also advocate for defunding the police, and she stayed in office for as long as she did. I can't understand that. But
me neither. I don't know. We could do a lot of speculation about that, but I do want to. Well, something you just said is going to take us into today's study, I should say, because you and I both share a very deep appreciation for history, especially American history, the history going back to the founding days of this country even. And there's a lot of tired old arguments that have been put to bed countless times, actually, many times already, that there is no individual right of the people to keep and bear arms. It's only a collective right, and it's only if you're part of the militia that you may keep and bear arms, and only while in service with the militia. They always seem to forget that one two-word phrase there in the Second Amendment that's found in the First Amendment and the Fourth and everything else. The phrase is the people. They concentrate on the militia and not the people. The problem is all these people are woefully ignorant of historical context regarding the right of the people to keep and bear arms. And that's where we come in today. Let's take a look back at two of the writings of James Madison, and the other one, for some reason, is I'm having a brain hiccup. Refresh my memory, please.
Alexander Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Who unfortunately met his end in a duel with Aaron Burr, did he not? There was two factions prior to the installation of the Constitution of the United States here. And one of them were a group who wanted a federation, the states to be under one banner of a federation. They would still be individual states, they would still have their own autonomy, but that would be part of a collective called the federation, or in other words, they wanted a federal government, a centralized government that presided over, not necessarily ruled, the 13 states that were in existence at that time. The anti-federalists, and I'd probably be more inclined to be in that camp than anything, because especially with where the federal government has gone today, they said, no, we just want individual states, period, and we want to have our own individual constitutions. Well, frankly, I can see both sides of that issue. I really can. If you're not united under a common cause, under a set of common laws also, that it could easily devolve into tribalism, and next thing you know, you got Georgia and Florida going to war with each other, and then South Carolina getting involved in it, and all those things would be very easily able to happen if it was just a loose confederation of states who all supported each other and such. So we're going to be taking a look at, not only in this episode, but the next episode, two of the writings of Mr. Hamilton and James Madison, who wrote under pen names. And the first one is Federalist Paper number 29. Now, the reason I'm going back here all the way to 1788 and these Federalist Papers and such is because, quite frankly, there's nothing new under the sun. It's the same old crap in a different package. And just like today, where they're saying, well, you don't have the right to keep and bear arms because that was a collective right given to the militia. Well, every time someone says something like that, I ask them, have you ever read any of the Federalist Papers? The answer is predictable, no. Okay. How about any of the anti-Federalist papers? Again, no. So in other words, they take the text of a document written back in 1788 and ratified in 1791, and they try to use modern-day definitions of words and things and come to erroneous conclusions. So AFA and I are going to be talking about the Federalist Paper number 29. Now, just a brief introduction into this. Again, the differences between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, they were vast, they were huge, they were varied, they were very complex. The Federalist beliefs could probably be described in the old sense of the word nationalism, not today's denigrated, you know, sense of the word. They wanted there to be a distinct unity between the states, and they knew it could only be founded on agreeable principles, namely the principles of liberty for all. The Federalists were very instrumental in 1787 in shaping the new U.S. Constitution, which was going to be ratified just, 4 years later. I'm trying to do math in my head. That doesn't work all the time. It strengthened the national government at the expense, according to the Anti-Federalists, of the states and the people. Well, that really wasn't true. The Anti-Federalists were very opposed to the ratification of the Constitution itself, but they never organized efficiently across the 13 states that were in existence at that time, which would have ironically made them a federation. And so they had to fight ratification at each and every state convention. That's 13 of them. So the big success was in them being able to force the first Congress under the new Constitution to establish a Bill of Rights to ensure the liberties that the Anti-Federalists actually believed at that time that the Constitution violated. Well, that just simply wasn't true. AFA, I'm going to give you a chance to dive in here, and you've been studying this and chewing on this for several weeks now, I know for a fact. I want to hear what's in your mind. Give it to us.
I loved your idea, Royce, originally when you suggested discussing Federalist Papers 29 and a couple others as well. It has been quite some time since I have actually really combed through these historical documents. I don't even think I read them in high school. But I'm so mired in technical readings in my doc program. It was a refreshing reprieve to read something for pleasure instead of technicality.
Right.
I would like to just first say, as we dive into this, my goal, and I think you would agree, Royce, in discussing this Federalist paper, is not to present to your vast listenership, which is nationwide and worldwide, just a history class. You know, that's one goal, edification and knowing about history just for the sake of edification. That's all well and fine, but I think the goal here can be elevated to an even higher purpose where listeners can be edified but also gain more tools for how to navigate the current modern political climate that we are faced in today, because mm-hmm. as you and I, Royce, talk about, it's not necessarily two completely distinct entities. You know, history in the 18th century and then today, we are inextricably linked in many ways. And as you said, the phrase, there's nothing new under the sun. Mm-hmm. When you read Federalist Paper 29 and all the others as well, but we're focusing on 29, all very clearly, those were very, very different times in many ways. But what is the same then and today is human nature.
There it is, right there.
These people were ferociously, our founding fathers were ferociously determined to see that government was designed in a certain way that aligns with their vision. Their passion radiates off the page. It's this was written in sophisticated, older English style. Right. It's actually very beautiful to read. But that same core sentiment applies to today. There's a common refrain that's bandied about in society today. We hear it all the time. We're more polarized than ever.
Yes.
I think we're very polarized.
Have been for a long time.
Exactly. I'm not convinced it's more than before. I think what's different is the tools at our disposal to express our views. Mm-hmm. So back in the day, you know, they had long guns and swords, and today we have lawyers and courts and social media. But I mean, just take the Civil War, for example, the Union and the Confederates. That was very much a bloodbath. And what was the ultimate reason guiding this, all this bloodshed? Was people wanted to have their vision of how power is arranged. Mm-hmm. Who can do what and when and why? Everyone wants their say. That is at the core of the founding documents, this polarized state we live in today, and even along the way, such as the Civil War. Everyone wants to have their say about how government is designed, who has power, the arrangement of power. So there is nothing new under the sun. It's just the way things look and feel, and our tools are just different than they were before.
Well, they say that war is politics by extreme means, and that's a very true statement. That's an excellent point there. We've always wanted to have our vision for government fully enacted, not just enacted, but fully enforced. So I don't want to interrupt this because I know you're on a good rant here. I want to let you take off again.
Well, so how I view Federalist Paper 29, and I'm not a licensed historian by any means, but I love
history. Historians have to be licensed?
I imagine in today's world some government entity exists that where you have to pay an annual fee and get a license, but I love...
Probably most of the stinking Federalists.
Right. I love history like you do, Royce, but to me, my love of history stems from the fact that, well, what are the takeaways? You know, economics, I'm a student of economics. Economic principles tell us that human behavior is usually rational. We care about ourselves. Mm-hmm. So everything has to mean something. So why are you listening to this podcast? Why are we discussing and going back in time to Federalist Paper 29? Because it has useful takeaways for today, for people today, that you can use in your own everyday life. And that's why we're talking about this. That's why I love history.
Yes.
So the way I see Federalist Paper 29, so Hamilton is making this case to his peers. So he and all the others in these founding documents, they, in a broad stroke, they generally agree on the larger mission that we want to set up this government in a way where tyranny will not be in place.
Yes. Considering what they just came through, yeah, totally understandable, right?
Yes. Yeah. And then in the execution of the details is where there was some divergence mm-hmm. amongst the founding fathers. So we all want to avoid tyranny. We believe in God-given rights and freedom of the people. We know this is a bit of an experiment. And so some said, well, you know, when it comes to the Second Amendment and militia, that should just be left to the states. So Hamilton makes this great argument that, hey, I don't want tyranny either, but if we have a foreign invasion, there is good reason for there to be a military presence at the federal level, and there would not there the risk would be so low for tyranny to arise that the benefits outweigh the costs.
And the reason he said that was because his point was, we don't want to do away with the state militias. We might need to call you forth too. But they argued for a central force, a centralized government force, federal force, I should say, that not only could be used to respond to insurrection or attack from without, but also to train the militia, because part of the Constitution calls for Congress to have the power to arm and to train the militia. And as a matter of fact, those words appear in this very Federalist paper here too. So sorry if I interrupted there. I just want to make a point real quick. Please continue. You're doing a fantastic job.
No, not at all. I appreciate that. That's an excellent point. You know, tying this to individual Second Amendment rights, which we normally focus on in this podcast. And what we're kind of touching on today speaks to general defense of the nation. Mm-hmm. But Hamilton actually cites individual Second Amendment rights in his argument that there should be a federal militia, because he says, hey, I think the chances for tyranny to arise are so low because the states ultimately have power. If tyranny were to even threaten to rear its head, the states, the power of the people, the fact that we have more armed citizens in this country compared to many other countries, they will stop that from happening.
Yes. Amen. You know what? Tying that to today, I firmly believe with every fiber of my being, the fact that we are a free people and we are armed and many of us are very well trained under arms has kept the wolf of tyranny from Washington, D.C., doing what they've been wanting to do for a long time. I firmly believe that the armed citizen and just our mere presence under arms has been what has kept many a despot from, you know, what should I say, on the leash and not... I believe we're the reason we're not a communist country right now, to put it in bold terms. I really do. I wish I could articulate that long enough, but we're on a time crunch here. But the fact that the government knows, in other words, I've said this before, why do you think they're trying to disarm us? Because they fear us being armed. It has nothing to do with public safety. You know that. I know that. Our listeners all know that. It has nothing to do with public safety. It has everything to do with what one of the founders said. Every time a government turns tyrannical, they must first destroy the militia to build their little kingdom on the ashes thereof. Now, I've totally misquoted that, I know, but... In other words, we have to disarm the people before we can enslave them. There's no other way to do it. You can't bring the people under total control if they're armed and able to say no. And that's exactly what the anti-federalists were saying. Hey, wait a minute. We don't want you guys rearing, we don't want even another King George. We don't want an Americanized version of King George. We don't want an Americanized version of tyranny. Tyranny is something that they knew from history, because they were students of history just like you and I are. They knew from history that governments always descend into tyranny unless they are governed and watched by the people. And that's what this is.
It is the nature of the beast of government to encroach and to grow bigger and bigger.
Necessary evil, but necessary nonetheless. So.
Yes, so I think we see that Hamilton was ultimately successful in what he was advocating for, and he emphasized, I am very cautious about tyranny as well. I loved how he couches his argument. He puts it in an economic frame, which is the language I speak. He said, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but in these human endeavors, these designing the government, we can't ever guarantee that all risk will be mitigated or zeroed out. When Hamilton is advocating for there to be a militia at the federal level, one thought you expressed in the opening of this podcast, Royce, was that in a sense you see both sides of the issue: Federalists, anti-federalists. Should we have a federal level militia or just keep it to the states? I also see both sides, but I think Hamilton was ultimately successful in his point of view. But I think in Federalist Paper 29, Hamilton also sees both points of view. He recognizes the fear that those who don't want a federal militia have because they're worried about tyranny encroaching and rearing its head. Hamilton was steadfast and determined to be a partner in designing this government so that it's airtight, so that not only will tyranny not be present in their day, but also not come about later in life, that there's no loopholes. So he makes these arguments, and I like that he casts it in kind of a pros and cons framework, where he says,
yes,
hey, I get it.
A lot like the gun control debate today, yeah.
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 He doesn't say, well, I want militia at the federal level because it's a perfect solution. He acknowledges there's always going to be some degree of risk in any human endeavor.
Amen.
Alexander Hamilton, cannot guarantee you that all risk is mitigated, but I've analyzed the situation and the risk level is so low that the benefits of having a federal militia far outweigh the scant costs that could be associated with it. So I like how he frames that argument, and those benefits that he lays out are the ultimate defense of the nation.
Yes.
That we will be more prepared as this newly formed autonomous free nation to defend ourselves from foreign invasion or any other major threat if we have a militia at the federal level supported by states and armed citizenry, of course. But we should be allowed to fund this every 2 years, even in times of peace. If we don't have, so what's the opportunity cost? Let's say we didn't have federal militia. Well, that might make some people in some states happy, but we're not going to be properly prepared to defend ourselves. We'll be obliterated.
Well, very true. And here's the thing. I've heard many people tell me, and they speak in a blanket fashion, that our founders never wanted a centralized government. They didn't want a standing army. Well, that's not true. A lot of them did want a standing army. They didn't want a massive standing army like Britain. They knew the bane of a standing army was a threat to liberty in a very big way, because an army is power. I say this on my program all the time. Political power comes out of the barrel of a gun. Like it or not, it's true. That's the only thing I will ever agree with Mao Zedong and Joseph Stalin on. And the reason that they want to disarm us now is to lessen our political power. I say this all the time. The people of Cuba have no political power because they're not armed. The people of Russia, same thing. The people of China, same thing. They have no political power because they are not allowed to be armed. They understand that when you have a giant force like that, a big military, that you get somebody of a despotic nature or somebody that gets up there and they become corrupted with the sense of their own worth and power, it's very easy for them to use that power of a big military against the people. It has happened all down through history. Our founders knew that, and that's why there was such vehemence against it from the anti-federalists especially. We're going to take a brief commercial break right now and hear from some of the mighty fine sponsors that take care of this program and keep it rolling. And we'll be back with more AFA here on the Shooting Straight Radio podcast as we discuss Federalist Paper number 29. Be right back. Don't go anywhere, because the listener retention squads are on standby.
The American Police Hall of Fame. We are the keepers of the history of individual law enforcement officers. We are a facility that honors the fallen and supports their families. We are a training facility that teaches civilians how to be their own first responder. We are a great place to visit and learn. Go to aphf.org to find out more.
Hey y'all, Rockin' Rod from Sigerman here. As y'all know, I am a licensed gun dealer, so if you're looking for firearms, you need to sell some, like to trade some, you can reach me at 561-445-0429. You know it, I know it, everybody with a brain knows it. Some just don't feel quite right now. Trust your gut, folks. Take care of each other. And never forget, taxation is theft.
Sigerman, godfather of the dirty hippie mafia.
Welcome back to Shooting Straight Radio. Thank you to the sponsors of this program for keeping it rolling. I really appreciate you guys. You've been keeping this thing rolling for 9 years now, and my appreciation is unfathomable. And we've been talking about Federalist Paper number 29. We're about to go into Federalist Paper number 46. The reason we've been diving back into history, myself and my distinguished guest, AFA, is because the past and the present meet in these writings. And as we said at the beginning of the program, there's nothing new under the sun. It's the same crap in a different package, just a little bit more shiny than the last time they tried to feed it to you. And so let me just real quick to get the ball rolling, get us back into the swing of things here. Let me find my cursor on this computer. Here we go. Okay. The emphasis and the, what should I say, the contention between the Anti-Federalists and the Federalists was they didn't want a standing army. The Anti-Federalists did not want a standing army. The Federalists said, well, we kind of need a standing army. And one thing they both were able to agree on, fortunately, is that the people needed to be armed, because that was the counterbalance to tyranny. No matter where its nasty little head reared up, the people being armed is the surest defense of liberty in any nation. A king or a president cannot easily oppress and become despotic and behave like a bunch of rank nasty communist totalitarians if their intended victims have a say. And the only way we have a say is if we are armed. Now, Mr. Hamilton, writing in Federalist Paper number 29, and we're about to see where he and James Madison both agreed. Let me read this to you. It's in the Old English prose, and I will try to, in my inferior redneck dialect, translate this for you. He said, "But if circumstances should at any time oblige the government to form an army of any magnitude, that army can never be formidable to the liberties of the people while there is a large body of citizens, little, if at all, inferior to them in discipline and the use of arms, who stand ready to defend their own rights and those of their fellow citizens. This appears to me the only substitute that can be devised for a standing army, the best possible security against it, if it should exist." Aoife, I'd like your thoughts on that.
I think the fact that in the early formation of our nation, the fact that there was even this heated debate about whether we should have a federal standing army or just state militias, the fact that that debate was even going on, that our founding fathers were so careful and deliberate and thoughtful about every word they wrote, yes, and spoke, because they knew the implications and the consequences of what they were doing, and they cared so much to make sure that there is integrity in the process, both then and in the future for all people. I think the fact that there's even this Federalist, Anti-Federalist debate going on is a credit to the exceptionalism of our country. Yes. And just go look to many other countries and how they were formed and how they're run to see that the well-being and the rights of the common man are not considered by the leaders of the nation.
Yeah, it wouldn't be great if the politicians of today thought the same way they did back then, and they wanted to be deliberate about everything. They wanted to be careful about their words. They wanted to measure them in such a way that that people years from them in history would look back at their words and go, you know what? This is the standard. This is the principle. I'm very grateful. You know what? I'm glad these arguments took place. I really am, because, you know, I, for today's sake, we can tie the yesterday to today, especially when we're talking about people like little Davy Hogg and other braying jackasses out there trying to say that the right to keep and bear arms was never an individual liberty, but it only belonged to the militia. In the same breath, they try to say, well, the militia, there's no need for militia anymore because the National Guard is now the militia. And that is a steaming huge pile of bull fertilizer, and it's certainly another podcast to go into. But everything we're talking about right now blows that crap out of the water.
I think as we discuss these Federalist Papers and what you and I, Royce, are trying to emphasize is the link to today. And so another example of that is, I guess in crafting law and policy, there's two main components. There's the big picture morality. Do we like this idea at all? So our founding fathers all agreed the citizens should be armed. They all agreed we don't want tyranny. We want a free country where people can defend themselves and be safe and happy and prosperous. then they diverged, of course, on how exactly to get there, but they agreed on the morality, the meaning, the big picture. But then the second part is process. Well, how do we do it? How do we implement this? Mm-hmm. So we see those same two parts of lawmaking today in every aspect of government. There's, well, do you agree with this bigger picture? Okay, yes, no, but then how do you properly implement it? And not to digress, but we see this President Joe Biden's student loan proposal just got heard by the Supreme Court on February 28th, and Justice Roberts says, he talking less about whether it's right or wrong to subsidize almost half a trillion in student loans, he was saying, our president didn't confer enough with Congress, the legislative body. He's acting too unilaterally in the executive branch. Mm-hmm. And so there's the process part, aside from, you know, the moral picture of whether you agree with an idea or not. All of that is happening here in Federalist Paper 29. Okay, here's, we want the same things, but how do we get it done and get it done right? And that's what these squabbles really amount to. Everyone kind of wants the same thing, but how do we get there? We saw that then in the late 18th century, and we see that today.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You use the term bigger picture, and the bigger picture is what drives the argument. And I think about that today, and you can tell a lot about what someone's bigger picture is by what they're arguing for. I really believe that, especially when you have many members of Congress and the Senate up there arguing in favor of liberty and freedom for the people and the right to keep and bear arms, and you've got another large portion of them, whom I call the Democrat Communist Party, who are up there doing their dead level best to pass law after law after law that infringes on liberty after liberty after liberty. It's not hard to see what their bigger picture is. Obviously, they've got plans for a large part of the country, and that would be a large part of the country that they obviously do not like. Now, if I want to bring this out here, unless you want to throw another point on top of that one. If you do, take it away.
Sure. I'd also like to mention in Federalist Paper number 29, going back to what we've been emphasizing, that there's nothing new under the sun. There is a clause by Hamilton, says, not much calculated to inspire a very favorable opinion of the sincerity or fair dealing of their authors. Hamilton is talking about his critics. Mm-hmm. And what I believe he's saying here is that his critics are not just attacking his ideas about a federal standing army, but they attack the authors. And we see that all the time in today's discourse, where if one disagrees with another, they don't necessarily just attack the idea. They go after the person and right. call names and engage in ad hominem attacks. And discourse is just very, very sloppy today. But I will say, and again, people say we're so polarized today. I think we just see, hear, and feel it more because of social media, because of the 24/7 news cycle. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's actually happening more, though. We just see it more, so we're more aware of it. But that clause in Paper 29 reminds us that even back then, when people were in heated debates and passionate about what they were advocating for, they would attack the idea, but they would also attack the author, mm-hmm. the messenger.
Human
so
nature.
Yeah. Yes. So again, there's nothing new under the sun. I'm not convinced we're more polarized than we were before. It just looks different.
Well, I remember reading stories about congressmen literally assaulting and battering each other in the middle of Congress. They were talking about back in the 1800s with canes and sticks and threatening to cut each other's heads off. We've been reading Alexander Hamilton, who was goaded into a duel with Aaron Burr and lost his life, you know, because of that. That's the kind of stuff that went on back then. Of course, they've outlawed dueling these days, much to my chagrin. But anyway, here we are.
And I don't know if the purpose is, if that's supposed to make people feel better or worse, to remind them that there's nothing new under the sun and human nature is really the same as it's always been. But it is a fact, and I think it's a good perspective as we people navigate the current political waters, and they read things, they see things, and they're voting, and they don't know how to make sense of it. And I think we, of course, we're polarized, but I would just urge more perspective on people and voters that it's not as bad as it seems sometimes. Even if things seem bad, it's always been bad.
Because there's always been humans, and human nature stinks, I tell you what. Selfishness is the purest form of evil, and when people go into a discussion selfishly, only wanting their thing to be heard, well, that's going to be the end result of it. The same, the bickering between the anti-federalists and the federalists, too. So, yeah, nothing new under the sun. But in trying to assuage the anti-federalists and say, look, your fears are unfounded because there are certain facts that you're not considering. Much like we try to tell the anti-gun people today, the anti-rights people, the pro-infringement crowd that says the only possible way we can be free from fear and that we can be safe is to disarm the entire country and transform the entire populace into one giant gun-free zone where evil people can operate without fear of armed resistance. It's the same thing back then as it was today. And so in 1946, Madison is trying to assuage the fears of the anti-federalists. And I'm going to read a little bit of this, and it's a little bit lengthy. I want you to listen on purpose, though. The old English way of saying things might seem a little distant, but I will translate as best as possible. He said, "Let a regular army, fully equal to the resources of the country, be formed, and let it be entirely at the devotion of the federal government. Still, it would not be going too far to say that the state governments, with the people on their side, would be able to repel the danger. The highest number to which, according to the best computation, a standing army can be carried in any country does not exceed 1/100th part of the whole number of souls, or 1/25th part of the number able to bear arms. This proportion would not yield in the United States an army of more than 25 or 30,000 men." Now, he's speaking in the numbers of their day, 1787, 1788. Those numbers are much higher now, but still, I will tell you right now, we grossly outnumber the United States armed forces. So if they ever did decide to wax despotic, there's a lot more of us than there are of them. So he continues. He said, "To these would be opposed," in other words, against those 25 or 30,000 federal troops would be opposed a militia amounting to nearly 500,000 of citizens with arms in their hands, officered by men chosen from among themselves, fighting for their common liberties and united and conducted by governments conducted by governments possessing their affections and confidence. It may well be doubted whether a militia thus circumstanced could ever be conquered by such a proportion of regular troops. Those who are best acquainted with the late successful resistance of this country against the British arms will be most inclined to deny the possibility of it." So he takes them back to recent history of just a few short years ago and says, look, we militiamen were, the militia of this country were hugely instrumental in kicking the British back across the pond. They played a major part of it. When the colonial Minutemen were not enough, the militias bolstered the standing army. So he says, basically, look, you've got the entire populace out there. We could maybe muster 25 to 30,000 under the federal banner. Well, what is that against 500,000 people, also armed, also trained, officered by people of their state who share their sentiments about liberties, shares their thoughts and everything about wanting to be free? So he says they wouldn't have a chance. So your thoughts?
Yes. In Federalist Paper 46, James Madison is definitely backing up, so to speak, Alexander Hamilton and reiterating a lot of the same thoughts, but just expounding further. But yes, he's making that argument that, you know, trying to quell the fears that tyranny would arise. He would say, even if we have this standing army, here's what it would look like. Here's how many people there would be. there's no way they could successfully carry out tyranny with the federal government. With look at the power of the states and the citizenry. Like, let's, you know, weigh the pros and cons and practically look at how this would look with a standing army. This is not standing army at the federal level does not represent the threat of tyranny, and he's making that case over and over again, backing up Hamilton.
Mm-hmm. Well, the point is, he also continues here as to why we Americans are the bulwark against the tyranny, just like they were of their day. It's the same thing today. He says, besides the advantage of being armed, which the Americans possess over the people of almost every other nation, the existence of subordinate governments to which the people are attached and by which the militia officers are appointed forms a barrier against the enterprises of ambition. That would be a polite word, way of saying government tyranny, more insurmountable than any which a simple government of any form can admit of. Notwithstanding the military establishments in several kingdoms of Europe, which are carried as far as the public resources will bear, the governments are afraid to trust the people with arms. Now, let's attach that to today. What are we at? We have people in government. Matter of fact, one of them sitting in the big seat at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue saying, we're going to ban assault weapons. Well, what he's basically saying is, we're going to disarm the people. We're going to make it so you cannot defend yourselves against us. He knows good and is thinking, well, it has nothing to do with public safety. You don't turn the entire country into a gun-free zone because some scumbag walked into a gun-free zone and shot a bunch of people. And so he's saying here the same thing. He says, our government here is not afraid to trust the people with arms.
I do hope this discussion is digested by people in the state of Florida where we reside, but everywhere, as we look at possibly having permitless carry, open constitutional carry. We'll see what the legislature does with it. I appreciate they're looking at it. I think it could be a good thing, depending on the final product. But this potential bill here in the state of Florida, this is why we discuss these things about the founding fathers and how they talked about guns and the right to bear arms and freedoms, because it still applies today. We are debating and looking at open constitutional carry now. What do you think the founding fathers, Royce, would think of state of affairs today, not just in Florida, but in the nation, when it comes to the right to bear arms and freedoms of the people as they envisioned it?
I think they would be infuriated, number one, that so many of them sacrificed their lives, their liberty, and their pursuits of happiness. Their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor in the establishment and defense of liberty. So many people since their day have given life and limb to defend these rights that we hold dear. And people of many states now, which I call the communist-occupied territories of the United States, and it's funny that they're all coastal cities, mostly. Anyway, but it's funny then that this is what we're seeing now. People are allowing their government to disarm them. You got assault weapon ban in California, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York. They have no right to do that. You don't get to say for your own safety, you must not have these kinds of weapons because some bad guy did something bad with one. Therefore, the free exercise of your rights and your liberty is contingent upon what he did. Bull fertilizer. That ain't how it works.
Absolutely. I've never been in favor of policy where everyone is punished and faced with consequences because of the actions of a few.
Well, and that happened here in Florida in 2018 with the passage of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Act, and a bunch of cowardly people up there in the Florida State Legislature said, well, we have to do something. Well, I said this, but matter of fact, I sent this to Marco Rubio and got his usual canned response back. And I said, sir, the best thing you and every other so-called Republican up there that voted for this crap, what you should have done is dug your heels in and said, yes, we do need to do something. We need to take the shackles off your free exercise to keep and bear arms, and we need to unscrew this crap in the schools. We need to have armed people there to defend against this, because being unarmed invites evil. Being defenseless invites evil. They should have said, what we're going to do is we're going to stand up for and we're going to defend your right to keep and bear arms. We're not going to give into this. We're not going to let ourselves be used on and washed over with this emotional tidal wave, and we're going to do the right thing. Infringing the rights of all Floridians is not going to keep another scumbag from walking into a school and shooting a bunch of people here in Florida. It doesn't work that way.
Looking at human nature, whether we're talking about tyranny, which we've been discussing, or the actions of, say, a mass shooter today, what do you think a threat looks like when the assailant knows that everybody's armed and knows how to defend his or herself versus, okay, what am I going to do knowing that everyone's unarmed or armed? That's why we don't have tyranny in the U.S. because we largely, although our laws are flawed, we largely more or less have the right to bear arms. That's why we don't have tyranny like other countries have. Go and these mass shooters, they target places where people are vulnerable.
Yes.
And
98.5% of these shootings take place in gun-free zones.
What does that potential shooter say? If we have our schools hardened and armed, I think that reduces the crime. We all know that. There's no study that shows there's a link between decreased crime and gun-free zones. Royce, you and I have talked about this before. But this is why we're discussing these Federalist Papers today, because our views, our laws, our policies, our thoughts, our rights when it comes to the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, to defend ourselves individually, to defend our nation from foreign threats, it mattered then, it matters today, even if the issues look a little bit differently, they're ultimately reduced to the same core issues.
Yes, amen to that. And that's how we tie the past to the present now. I like what Hamilton said. I'm sorry, well, not, this is 46. What Madison said, and he wrote under the pen name Publius, he said, "Let us not insult the free and gallant citizens of America with the suspicion that they would be less able to defend the rights of which they would be in actual possession than the debased subjects of arbitrary power would be able to rescue theirs from the hands of their oppressors." Very well said, and that also lends to what I said earlier. Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. He points to, even back then, he points to other nations that were under despotism, they were under tyranny, and all of them, in every one of them, their government, their kings, their queens, whatever, refused to trust the people with arms. And that's why he says, let's not insult the gallant citizens of America, that they're not going to be able to defend themselves and defend their rights. Compared to people in Cuba, people in China, like today. So, yeah, it's all the same. It's all the same thing, and just a little bit different package, isn't it?
I appreciate how Hamilton and Madison, as founding fathers, they are in the process of crafting documents to set up government in this new free nation. And in their own writings, they're writing basically about themselves. Hey, if we're the government, we know that we could be the problem. Mm-hmm. We know that things could get out of control. I don't know a politician today who talks that way about his or herself, that I'm the problem.
Or I could be the problem, because human nature, as they say, the best of men are men at best. And, well, we see that even today, Afa. We see state after state that has a corrupt governor who will not trust the people with arms. So there are microcosms of this issue in America today. Governor Gavin Newsom, he would never trust Californians under arms. He would never, the governess of New York, Ms. Hochul, oh my goodness, she is trying to pass law after law after law against the free exercise of the right to keep and bear arms and self-defense. So, yeah, again, there's nothing new under the sun, really, is there? And if you can't hear her, she's shaking her head no. Okay. Well, one more point I'd like to bring out before we draw this to a close, Afa. He said, let us rather no longer insult them with the supposition that they can ever reduce themselves to the necessity of making the experiment by a blind and tame submission to the long train of insidious measures which must precede and produce it. And the whole point was, he said, let's not in. Here's the problem with governments and governors and presidents today. They think they're above the people. They forgot that they're human beings just like you and I. They forgot that they put their pants on the same way we do. They forgot that they brush their teeth the same way we do. They have assumed that their station and position in life has somehow advanced them to a status far above the rest of us mere peons, and they begin to think about us as less than them. Unfortunately, some of them began to become afflicted with delusions of personal deity, but that's another long historical discussion. And back, compare that to back then. He said, let's not insult the people into us supposing or telling them that they should suppose that they cannot defend their own freedoms if necessary. Your thoughts?
I think education is really important, because it's one thing for you and I to discuss this, but if younger generations are growing up not learning to understand, appreciate, and respect our founding fathers, even if you have different varying political point viewpoints, that's fine. But there has to be a fundamental understanding of these things, or it doesn't matter. It's just me and you sitting in a studio recording on a podcast, and someone, you know, somewhere is listening. I was on a work trip last year, traveling for a conference, and two wonderful ladies I work with, they're intelligent, they're talented, and they're thoughtful, caring people. We were standing in the lobby of a hotel waiting on someone else to join us, and somehow an issue came up, and they both said, yeah, didn't they, the founding fathers, they just threw together the Constitution drunk in a bar. And they meant that. They had no...
Where'd they get that from? Besides some disinformation somewhere.
Because there isn't a foundation of education.
A foundation of real facts.
Of facts. But, I mean, sitting combing through Federalist Paper 29 and 46, I mean, I don't think that I looked at this in high school. I mean, this is a self-chosen endeavor to comb through these papers and to understand who these people were. Why did they write what they write? What did they mean? And what does it mean for today? This critical thinking, this higher level thinking, I don't think it happens in our schools. I definitely teach this stuff to my son.
Yes, and I to mine too. Both of my boys, they both have a healthy respect for American history, American principles, the principles of freedom, and especially the Bill of Rights. If you don't know what your rights are, well, then you'll never know if I took them. That's the problem with that. And a lot of people don't understand, well, the Second Amendment gives you the right. No, Second Amendment doesn't give me crap. The Second Amendment is only words on paper. The Second Amendment is a recognition of a pre-existing right. None of the Bill of Rights grants you anything. It's simply an enumeration of the rights that we were all born with, all men were born with. And matter of fact, we can thank the Anti-Federalists for that, because they were the ones that said flat out, there will be a Bill of Rights in this Constitution. If you want this federal government and you want to be able to call forth a federal army, there needs to be in our founding laws and documents a Bill of Rights explaining what the rights of the citizens are and forbidding the government to infringe on them. That's the beauty of that. So thank God for the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, but more than that, thank God that they were educated men and not like a lot of the people in Washington, D.C. today. Take it away.
I like how you just phrased that. You really understand your right, maybe not until it's taken away.
Yeah.
I never understood the defund the police movement. I don't care whether you're liberal or conservative or somewhere else. If your house is being broken into, if you're being assaulted or robbed or hurt or harmed in some way, Would you not call the police even if you voted for Barack Obama or Bill Clinton? Would you not still want law enforcement to come to your rescue and keep you safe?
Well, more than that, if you're in one of the states where you're forbidden to be armed, you what else are you going to do? You don't have any other recourse. I mean, here in Florida, thank God, we have, for the most part, we have our rights uninfringed, even though there is still infringement written within the Florida Constitution. But we are our own first responders down here. We call the police to make the report. You don't have that luxury in New York. You don't have that luxury in New Jersey, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Maryland, Massachusetts, California, and all the other communist-occupied territories. So why would you want to defund the people who have been set up as your guardians, especially when you can't even protect yourself?
Absolutely. And this kind of goes back to what we touched on earlier, which is crafting policy that punishes everyone for the actions of a few. Of course, we see things occasionally where there are bad apples in police departments. There are bad apples in any organization. You can read about a bad teacher. That doesn't mean all teachers are bad.
Right.
So again, this defund the police because of the actions of a few is very illogical and goes against people being able to stay safe.
Yeah, well, more than that, it's the same logic used that we have to disarm the entire country because one person did something bad with a gun, and we're not going to be safe unless everybody is equally unprotected. And that's just a huge fallacy and, again, a steaming pile of brontosaurus crap. So, Aoife, I really appreciate having you on the program today. It's been a pleasure to have you. Please tell me right here on the air in front of everybody, you'll be back again soon.
I'll think about it.
Oh, come on. All right. What's
of
your
course.
Email? I'm going to give everybody your email. They're going to harangue you and say, we want you back on the program.
Well,
you don't have to do that.
No, of course I'll be back. I love having these discussions with you, and I hope it's meaningful and engaging for your listeners, and that this is a help and a good thing to people. I do need to know, though, are you going to be okay after the election loss of Lori Lightfoot?
I'll try to. I'm still trying to get over it. When you broached that subject earlier at the beginning of the program, and I had to wipe a few tears out of my eyes as I was laughing so hard. All right. All right, well, that's going to do it for this edition. Thank you again, Aoife, for being part of the program. We'll see you on the next one. And don't forget, stay in contact with your representatives. It's not just your right, it's your duty. This is the government of, by, and for the people, and you are the people. And so you better do your part. That is your job. Keep a loaded firearm on your person when you're outside the doors of your home. Keep your head on a swivel. Know your surrounding area and who's in your circle. And never forget, incoming rounds always have the right of way. Royce and Aoife are out of here.
Second Amendment University, class dismissed.